Our scripture reading is Galatians chapter 4, verses 28 and 29. Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. But just as at that time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, so also it is now.
Good morning. If you can believe it, I forgot to have an announcement made. It should be the easiest person in the world for me to remember to make announcements, and I forgot one. I was going to make a prayer request for my extended family, my sister-in-law, Teresa, my brother and sister-in-law in Nashville. One of her nephews, her brother's son, passed away this weekend. His name is Cordell Good. He was just 18 or 19 years old. It was a freak accident that happened over the weekend, complete shock to the family. And he lives here in this area. I'm going to be officiating the funeral tomorrow morning over in Sepulpa, and they're driving in from different places where they live. But Cordell Good, if you'd pray for the Good family and my family as well, we'd appreciate it. I didn't know him personally, but my extended family knows him pretty well, and it really just came as a shock, a young man starting his life out. We're going to be looking, continuing our look at the troubled life of Isaac, second lesson, and our final lesson on Isaac before we move to other things. Just a shameless plug for next week before we even get started. Remember that next week is Evangelism Sunday. And just to clarify, because I don't want there to be any confusion about the emphasis of the day, this is not an evangelistic Sunday. This is Evangelism Sunday. So what's the difference? This is not a Sunday where we're actually door-knocking the community and bringing people in to teach them the gospel. We're going to have something kind of like that that's more geared towards outsiders and sharing with the lost in the fall. This is aimed at our own membership and emphasizing the role of evangelism as a work of the church and getting our minds set in that direction. We have some projects upcoming leading up to Friends and Family Day in the fall that we want to focus on. And so this coming Sunday, we've set aside to emphasize in our Bible classes, in our sermons, in our devotional, all day long, the topic of evangelism and the pressing need for that in our churches. So we encourage you to be here and partake of that and be thoughtful of what's going on there. Today, we'll finish up Isaac. Last week, we had our first lesson on Isaac, and you may have noticed the lesson wasn't about Isaac. Isaac is a peculiar character in the Old Testament in that he's in lots of stories and does nothing in any of them. He is one of the most passive major characters in the Old Testament, to the point that if I ask you, tell me something about Isaac, you almost invariably start telling me things that happened to Isaac, but not anything that Isaac did. He's a little riddle in that sense, in that he's the promised son. He's the chosen one, right? That's the word used. He's a son of promise. Abraham prayed and prayed and prayed, and God says, through you, I'll bless all nations and all people. And here is that son that is the promised blessing, the result of your fervent prayer and the covenant of God. Here is Isaac. And what do you expect? You expect some kind of superhero. I mean, this is the promised son that we've been waiting on. He should be an exciting figure in this story. He should do lots of amazing things. He should be messianic. He is a promised, chosen heir of Abraham, and yet he is altogether a passive figure in all of his stories. Which makes this passage out of Galatians that we'll look at now all the much more fascinating to me. In Galatians chapter 4 and verse 28, I'm just going to drop this in and we're going to come back to it after we talk about Genesis. Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. So the point that Paul is making in Galatians, there's a dispute about Jew and Gentile and who is in fact a child of God, who is an heir of Abraham. And he says to those who are born of the Spirit, not of the flesh, he says, you are indeed, like Isaac, a child of promise. But here's our problem. I just explained it to you. What does it mean to be like Isaac? If I say, what's it mean to be like Abraham? You say, well, be faithful. If I say, what's it like to be like Jacob? You might say, be a scoundrel. I don't know. If you pick an Old Testament character, you kind of associate something like with it. What does it mean to be like Job? To be patient and suffering. What's it mean to be like Isaac? If I told you tomorrow I want you to act more Isaac-like, where would you even start? And so this passage is a little bit of a mystery that we have to kind of unravel when looking at the life of Isaac. What does it mean for us to be children of promise like Isaac? And what can we possibly take from that? What we're going to do in the next 20 minutes or so is just quickly, as fast as I know how to be, which is slow, we're going to quickly survey the stories about Isaac. We're not going to go into any great detail on any one of them. Just from cradle to the grave, we're going to look at the life of Isaac and see if we can notice a couple of trends of his troubled life. And there certainly are some troubles. The first story comes from Genesis chapter 21, and here, a portion of it on the screen, verses 8 through 10. And the child, this is Isaac, the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, this is Ishmael, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. So she said to Abraham, "Cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac." And the thing was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. First Isaac story we get is a situation that makes Abraham unhappy. It's a story that is tragic from the start, of jealousy, of rivalry, of envy, of which Isaac is completely passive. If you'll notice there in verse 9, Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. The word laughing there is a little bit confusing in Hebrew. There's a lot of different ways to take it. The ESV went very neutral, and they said laughing. That's the basic meaning. Some of the older translations took the term to be more like picking on, like Ishmael was mocking or ridiculing Isaac. The NRSV, I think, goes in a better direction, though. I think this fits better with the story. The NRSV says, "And she saw Isaac and Ishmael playing." Now, when you see two kids, two boys get together, what do? They invent stories and play games and laugh and carry on and make mischief. And yeah, there's some picking on them going back and forth between them. The older one's going to get the upper hand in that, and Ishmael's the older one, so I'm sure there's some of that too. But usually, you don't assume when you, even when you see one getting picked on just a little bit, you know, when Calvin comes to us and says, "Bubba, Bubba, cry, cry," I don't always assume that it's Lucas's fault, you know. Quite often, the younger brother, you know, has provoked, and they've been playing, and one didn't like the way the game went. This text says, you know, they were laughing. And that laughing, and that laughter is a threat to Sarah. Because laughing and playing together is what equals do. And my boy Isaac will not be an equal with that one. He's not going to grow up like a brother to that one. He's got to go. What was Isaac doing in this story? He's doing what boys do. He's doing what the boys do, and for that matter, so is Ishmael, as far as we know. Just doing what boys do. And yet, just the very existence of Isaac is enough to displace Ishmael in a tragic story that sees him and his mother on the outside. This is the very passage, in fact, that Paul quotes an allegory in Galatians 4, in the text I mentioned a moment ago. Isaac's childhood displaced Ishmael. From the very start, as it says at the end, this displeases Abraham. Isaac's story is troubled. If he's going to be in the picture, there may not be room for anybody else. Not because of his own doing, it's just the way the story goes. How about when he gets a little older? A young man and his father, this is last week's story. One of you asked me, what happens to Isaac after the story of the binding and almost sacrifice of Isaac? And my answer is, I'm not sure. All I can give you is a speculative answer, a very speculative answer. But there is an old Jewish tradition that's based on a few passages of Scripture very loosely, that after the sacrifice or the almost sacrifice of Isaac, Abraham and Isaac kind of go their separate ways. I don't know if you realize this when you do the math. Isaac at the scene in Genesis 22 when he's taken up the mountain is not 10 years old. Commentators put him anywhere between 18 and 30. He's not a kid. He is a nearly adult going up the mountain with his father. And the text is fairly emphatic in chapter 22, verse 6. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went, both of them, together. Two men go up the mountain, and then in verse 19, So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. Who's missing in the verse where they come down the mountain? Isaac isn't mentioned anywhere at the end of the chapter. I'm not saying he's still at the top of the mountain, but my point is, the text begins by saying two people go up the mountain, and it ends by saying, well, Abraham went back to his young men. We don't hear again about Isaac for some time. In the next chapter, for example, if I can move ahead there, yep. In the next chapter, 23, verse 2, Sarah dies, Isaac's mother, and usually it gives a list of all the attendees. And so was there, and so was there to mourn their mother. When Abraham dies, it lists who is there. When Isaac dies, it lists who is there. Jacob and Esau are there to bury their father. When Sarah dies, it says, she was at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Why isn't Abraham with Sarah? He goes to where Sarah died, and who is not mentioned in that story is Isaac. Now, fun note that one of you pointed out to me, he does end up with his mother's tent in the story that follows. And so there's some connection between the family, but it's interesting that the story is kind of told in this way, as if they're separate figures living separate lives. From chapter 22 on, Abraham, Isaac, and his mother, Sarah, don't have stories together anymore. In fact, Isaac in chapter 24, had returned to Beer Lahai Roy and was dwelling in the Negev. The Negev is a desert. He's not even with his father at all. He's in the distance. And Beer Lahai Roy is mentioned there, which just happens to be the story or the place where Ishmael and Hagar went after they were cast out. So after the almost sacrifice of Isaac, what does this do to a relationship? Speculative. I can't give you a firm answer, but it's fascinating that they all end up in different places. They don't end up at the funeral together. You know, usually even when you don't get along with family, you show up at the funeral. They aren't mentioned at the funeral together. They could have been there. And then Isaac ends up out in the desert from which he returns to the place where Ishmael and Hagar at one point found themselves banished. So that is a difficult relationship, I would say at the least. Being chosen of God and loved by your father, but in a way that leaves you up a mountain to be sacrificed, it's not easy being the chosen of God, is my point. Isaac, the best we can tell from chapter 24 in particular, at the end, lives a very solitary life. At the end of that chapter, which we'll read in just a moment, it says he was out in the desert thinking. That's what we see Isaac doing. That's the most Isaac does in any story in Genesis. He's out in the desert thinking. What does it mean to be Isaac? I think Isaac wanted to know that too. Same thing happens, or a similar passive story, with a groom and his bride. How does Isaac get his wife? Now, don't get me wrong, in the ancient world, marriages were also a very passive affair. Quite often it was arranged. But usually, the two people had something to do with it. So, for example, in the story, let me fast forward to the story of Jacob. How does Jacob get his wife? Jacob goes, and there's a well, and he meets a lady, and he falls in love. She's beautiful, and her name is Rachel. And he goes to the father, and he says, I want to marry this gal. And father says, that'd be fine. You're just going to work for me 7 years. Jacob says, absolutely. 7 years sounds fair, so he works 7 years. Surprise! He marries Leah instead. It was a trick. And so he's told, well, if you want to marry Rachel, it's going to be 7 more years. So what does he do? He works 14 years total. Is he an active participant? I mean, he's not the only one. It's still an arranged marriage, and there's a price to be paid, and it's awkward, and there's a trick, and all that. But in the end of the day, it's a story about Jacob. Jacob does some things. But if you turn to Genesis chapter 24, the story of how Isaac gets his wife goes like this. Abraham says to his servant, I'd like to get Isaac a wife. Promise me you'll get Isaac a wife. And so the first 5 verses of Genesis 24 is all about Abraham and a servant. Isaac never comes up. So the servant travels to the far country, to the kinsman, and like Jacob will, he goes to a well, not Isaac, the servant. The servant goes to a well because that's where you find a woman. And so he goes to the well and he starts looking for the right kind of gal. And this beautiful woman comes up, and her name is Rebecca. And she offers him water. I'll draw you water out of the well. In fact, I'll go ahead and water your camels and animals that you're traveling with as well, if you'd like. act of kindness to a complete stranger. He says, that's the one. You're the one I'm looking for. And they have an elaborate conversation about how I'm going to take you and you're going to go and marry my master's son. And it's going to be good for you. She says, okay, come tell Dad. So there's a whole story about the servant. We haven't seen Isaac at all. The servant goes in and the servant talks to the father and makes the arrangement. Husbands, did you ask your bride's father for her hand? Isaac did not. The servant did that. Servant did all the arrangements. Hey, I'd like the daughter to come marry my master's son. And he makes all the arrangements. And they travel and he brings her finally down. 65 verses about somebody else. That's the story of Isaac's courtship. 65 verses about Abraham saying, I want you to go find my son a wife. And here's how it ends. In chapter 24, beginning in verse 62, actually. Now Isaac had returned from Beer Lahai Roi and was dwelling in the Negev. He's in the desert. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening. And he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there were camels coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. By the way, the word dismounted there in Hebrew is also a funny word because you can't tell if she got down and prepared to bow herself or if she fell off the camel. It's kind of a funny word. But anyway, it would be a lot funnier if she saw Isaac and just fell clean off the camel, right? But anyway, where are we at? Dismounted from the camel and said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field to meet us? And the servant said, it is my master. So she took her veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. And that's the story. 65 verses of somebody else doing something. At the end, it works out. Isaac is out moping in the desert, trying to figure out what's going on. He's mourning because his mother has died. And here arrives Dad's servant with your wife. And he takes her in and he loves her. And he's comforted because of it. But he's not what you'd call an active participant in that story, is he? It's again a story about somebody. This is a story about Rebekah. I mean, really, if you read the whole chapter, it's a story about Rebekah and what a great catch she is. And how kind and how hospitable she is. And how wonderful she is. How lucky Isaac is to have Rebekah. It's a great story about Rebekah. Isaac's just along for the ride. How about another story about Isaac? How about a man and his heritage? This is a story we overlook in Genesis 26. The whole life cycle of Isaac just reads like Abraham's life on repeat. I'll summarize a bit of this because there's just too much to read. But in Genesis 26, he deals with a promise that he has handed to him from his father. Verses 1 through 6, now there was a famine in the land because the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. So it starts out, remember the famine of Abraham? Well, we're going to get another Abraham famine. And Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt, dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. So sojourn in this land and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. Isaac, God says, don't worry, I made a promise to your father. So the promise that he lives by and the script that he lives by, even during a famine, that sounds like his father's famine, based on a promise made to his father. Then he starts reliving his father's shortcomings. Do you remember the story of Abraham? He goes down to Egypt with his wife Sarah, and Pharaoh thinks Sarah's a catch. And so Abraham sees this coming, and he says, we don't want trouble down here in Egypt, so you tell everybody you're my sister, which was about half true because she was about a half sister. He says, tell him you're my sister. And then Pharaoh says, well, I'd like your sister then. And he takes her and there's famine and terribleness and God curses them. And he says, what have you done? Someone's lied to me. This isn't your sister. And so on. So Isaac, having fully learned from that mistake, goes into a distant country, not Egypt this time because God said not to go to Egypt. And he goes there and he says, hey, Rebekah, tell everybody that you're my sister. And what happens, someone tries to take her to be wife, and God curses and punishes them, and they say, hey, what are you doing? You lied to us. This is not your sister. And they play out the same shortcoming. It's like the exact same story with different people and different names. You ever find yourself doing the same dumb thing your parents did? Because you're way smarter, right? Yeah, I'll never do that. And then you're right in the middle of it, and you say, oh, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. That's what Isaac's life was quite a lot about. He meets in verses 12 through 16 his father's enemies. His father Abraham had dug wells, and the Philistines had filled them in. So he's got enemies. How did he get them? Just by being Abraham's son. He finds his father's wells, and there's a fight over them in verses 17 to 22. Not wells he dug, not his problem. It's his dad's wells. It's his problems, but he inherits them. And his father's God. Because every time that God speaks to Isaac, he always says, not I'm your God, Isaac. He says, I am the God of your father, Abraham. My point is not to say that he has no relationship with God or his life is completely irrelevant, but just the way the Bible tells the story always emphasizes how passive Isaac is. He has his father's mistakes, his father's problems, his father's promises, his father's God. He is the chosen promised child of God, and yet there's not a lot going on with him that's unique to Isaac. Even his moral failures aren't uniquely his. He repeats his father's moral failures. And so we come later on at one of the other memorable scenes in his life, his very last significant act. Isaac has put in his time. He has been whatever it was he was supposed to be. And at the end of his life, when he can barely stand, he's going blind, he has one thing to do that is his and his alone, and no one can take from him. The promise his father gave him of a rich blessing can be passed to his son. He's got two, Jacob and Esau. But that's backwards, isn't it? Esau and Jacob. Esau, they're twins, but Esau was born first. And it just so happens, not only was he born first, happened to be the one that Isaac liked. Isaac gets one thing in his life that's completely up to him, and no one can take it from him. He is going to bestow his blessing on his favorite son, Esau. And at least that much will go the way he planned. Some of you are snickering because you know how the story goes. Rebecca says, no, I don't think so. She hatches a plan with Jacob. And they deceive the blind old man. And he blesses Jacob instead. And when Esau comes to him and says, I'm ready for my blessing, Isaac says, I've already done it. I don't have anything else to give you. His last significant act taken from him. Read this passage. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and he said to him, my son, and he answered, here am I. He said, behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out of the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die. This is my last act. This is the end of the story. I haven't done much, but I will pass on the blessing to my favorite son. Nope, not even that. This isn't a story about you, it's a story about Jacob. And so it begins. What is Isaac's life about? It's barely about Isaac. So when you read those passages, what does it mean when Galatians says, you're a child of promise, just like Isaac? I'm not excited yet. I'm not sure I want to be like Isaac. And that also is Paul's point. Read the whole passage now. And include the second verse. Here's verse 28. Now you brothers like Isaac are children of promise, but, see, he knows this isn't a good thing. He says, but just as at that time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the spirit, so also it is now. What does he say? He says, it actually wasn't very easy being Isaac. He was a promised son. He was a blessed son. He was a chosen son. But that doesn't suddenly make things good in his life. It puts responsibility on him. It puts burdens on him. It puts him in a situation where he has to make difficult choices. It's a challenge to live that life. It included suffering. The book of Galatians has been a book about Jews and Gentiles, and the question has been, who are the children of Abraham? And in chapter 3, Paul has concluded, all of you, Jew and Gentile alike, who have faith in Jesus Christ and have put him on in baptism, you are the children of Abraham and heirs according to the promise. And in chapter 4, he says, but that may not be pleasant. It could be that you are now chosen to live a life of Isaac. And that's not always fun. What's the application of this lesson? What point does Paul want us to make? I think he makes the point, perhaps in another epistle. And let me ask you to turn. I didn't even make a slide on this one. Turn, if you would, to the book of Colossians, just briefly with me. And listen to the lesson I think we can learn from Isaac. Colossians here in chapter 3, verse 12. What do we all share when we read the life of Isaac? How about pity? Do you feel bad for Isaac? When you read his life and you say, he really got the short end of the stick. By being chosen and selected for this great honor, his life didn't turn out great. There were good things in his life, and I think there's more to the Isaac story than we're told. I think there must have been a lot of good days in between their bad. There is no such thing as a life that's completely bad, is there? Just like there's good days in between their bad, there's bad days in between the good. That's the way it works. I'm sure he had good days and days of rich blessing. He's listed anytime God's spoken of. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's important. But I think part of us also reads the story of Isaac and we pity him just a little bit, don't we? If you could, would you like to do something kind for Isaac? If you could, if you saw a person going through a rough patch, rough childhood, rough family life, rough adulthood, awkward adolescence, difficult old age, if you saw that life spilling out in front of you, would you like to do something kind to him? I think that I would. Listen to the lesson that Paul uses, same terminology. What does it mean to be chosen of God? Colossians chapter 3 and verse 12. Put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you, so that you also must forgive. And above all these things, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. What does it mean to be chosen of God? It's often a rough road. And for some reason, when we see fellow people on that road, that journey that we're on and the difficulties of it, we have zero patience for them. We expect people to look at us and understand, well, Ben, he's going through a lot of stuff right now. We ought to cut him some slack. When I'm going through a hard time, I just expect you to know that and treat me that way, don't I? We all do. We all expect people to cut us some slack. And then we see other people, and we don't care what they're going through, and we say, well, we're not cutting them any slack. And it's the worst with the people in this room. Because, see, these are Christian people. And we expect them to act right and live right and do right and be right. And so when they do something out of line or something we don't like, our patience is very slim. What does Paul say? We're the chosen one of God. And that's not easy. You know what would be good for the chosen ones of God to do? You know what would be kind? Is for them to be kind. Look at each other and realize that every person in this room who has accepted the life of faith, resurrected to live a new life in Jesus Christ, has also accepted the burdens that come with that. The difficulty of difficult home lives. We forget sometimes, we look around the room and we think everybody's got a perfect family, but me, here's the secret. Everybody's family is a mess. Everybody's family is a mess. And they're all going through stuff with their kids and their parents and their spouse. All of them are. And we look around the room and we think everybody's got their career together, but me, here's the secret. Everybody's career is a mess. All of them go through stuff at work, and it's difficult. And they're trying to be faithful, and they're trying to be good, and they're trying to do what God wants the chosen people of God to do, and it's difficult. And boy, I have rough times, but these folks don't. They've really got it all together. Here's the secret. They've all got rough stuff going on. So what does Paul say? You are the chosen of God, and so is everybody else in the room. Here's an idea. Have a heart of compassion. Have a heart of kindness. How about instead of nitpicking, let's forgive one another? When you look at Isaac's life, wouldn't you like somebody to just cut him a break? Just give that guy a break. Just one time. Isaac, you get a pass today. I think Paul is telling us that every day you encounter your brothers and sisters in Christ, you get to do that. You can show them the pity that you'd like to show Isaac, because these two are the chosen of God and worthy of a heart of compassion and of kindness. So here's your profound thought for today. Real big, deep stuff. Had to think real hard on it. be kind. Because life isn't easy. And that doesn't change when you become a Christian. It becomes more true when you are chosen of God, because now you're not only living the difficulties of life, you're doing it with the burden of moral responsibility of trying to please God. And sometimes that's tough. It's a blessing. It's rich. It's wonderful. I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it's tough too. I remember one time a young man was baptized, and my mother, source of all kinds of sage wisdom, went up to him and gave him a hug and said, "This is the hardest, best decision you'll ever make." And what she meant by that was exactly this. He had chosen the life of Isaac, and it was going to be tough. But thanks be to God that we have other people with us, not estranged from us unless we estrange them ourselves. People who can share in the burdens of Christianity and show to one another the kindness that the chosen of God ought to have one to another. This is your family, and I hope you treat them that way. If you would like help in following the path of God, if you would like to stop doing it on your own, but instead would put on Christ in baptism and let him be your guide, the forgiver of your sins, a merciful Savior, he says his yoke is easy and his burden is light. And if you would take up that yoke today as we stand and sing, won't you come?